The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture entitled The Genius of Nahar Dor, The Life and Times of Mar Shmuel and the Yeshiva of Nahar Dor, is dedicated to the memory of Le'ilui Nishmos, Rabbi Tzion Rav Rami Yeshua, Rabbi Mordechai Aryeh, Rabbi Moshe Simcha Halevi, Rochel Bas Rabbi Moshe Yecheskel, Aleihem HaShalom, a blessed memory.
Of all the great sages that are mentioned in the Babylonian Talmud, there's probably no one that is viewed with greater awe and affection and crowned with more titles than Shmuel, the son of Abba bar Abba HaKohen, known as Mar Shmuel, the Master Shmuel, variously called Shokud, the industrious scholar, Melech Shvor Malko, King Shapur, the Persian monarch. They used to refer to him with the same name as the Persian monarch, is referring to his esteemed position. And Arioch, which is the which is a word which refers to, there's various explanations, but it refers to the idea of aristocracy and rulership because of his acknowledged authority in Jewish law, especially in areas dealing with the courts and civil law. This scholar, Shmuel, who was almost solely trained in Babylon, gained prominence not only in Torah, but in the fields of medicine and astronomy as well. In fact, one of his titles is Shmuel Yarchinoi, the expert on the calculations and cycles of the moon, the key factor in determining the Jewish calendar. A man, according to the Gemara Nedorim, Nun Amud Beis in 50b, not blessed with impressive good looks, he compensated for it with his genius and diligence. Having spent relatively little time in Eretz Yisrael under the tutelage of Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi, his schooling and spiritual growth took place for the most part in Bovel in Babylon. Without the benefit of the intensity of training in the great yeshivas of Palestine, he grew to become a formidable scholar, despite the fact that it would seem that the majority of the truly outstanding scholars were in Palestine at the time. But yet he grew to become a giant in the age of giants. Yet with all his intensity and devotion to the study of Torah, he managed to develop an expertise in astronomy and medicine, and eventually became a confidant of the Persian king. What was the secret of his great talent and his wisdom? His story and legacy is the subject of tonight's lecture. I hope you all have the handouts. On the first page, in paragraph A, the Medrash Shmuel, this goes on the Sefer, this is a Medrash dealing with the book of Samuel, a biblical work, tells an amazing story about Shmuel's father, Abba bar Abba. He was involved in the silk business, as many in the time of the Talmud, especially those without an official position of Rosh Yeshiva, they had both a business or profession on the side, and they devoted all their spare time to study. Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, who lived in Nitzivan, a city on the Euphrates, but would seem quite far from Nahar Dor, the home of Abba Bar Abba, sent for him and was put in an order. It was a verb, as there wasn't a, but he expressed interest in buying his silk. It didn't go further than a verbal agreement. In other words, it wasn't face to face. It was through a letter of sorts. Sometime later, Abba Bar Abba came, took the trip from Nahar Dor to Nisibis, the Nisibin, and stood by him with his wares. Rehuda ben Becerra. Rehuda ben Becerra was one of the greats at the time of Rabbi Akiva. In fact, when the whole generation was killed out, Rabbi Akiva and all his colleagues, many of the 10 martyrs, Yehuda ben Becerra, who lived in Nitzivan, which was in Babylon, had a tremendous, even amongst a tremendous respect, even amongst the scholars in Israel, remained basically the senior scholar of that generation. And there's evidence from the Talmud Yerushalmi that when the Talmidei Rabbi Akiva, when the disciples of Rabbi Akiva fled and came to Babylon, they studied under Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra. So he was one of the outstanding people of that generation. And Abba Bar Abba must have been a young man at the time. Evidently, Rehuda ben Becerra had forgotten about the commitment. It was only, probably it wasn't a commitment to buy in a buy order. It was really just an expression of interest. And evidently he'd forgotten about it, or he had changed his mind. Abba Bar Abba had interpreted that expression of interest to be a true commitment for a sale, and he brought all the wares there, and he was surprised. Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra wasn't interested in buying. And Rabbi Yehuda replied, he says, I only made a verbal commitment. I didn't sign a contract. There was nothing really with teeth in our relationship, and therefore I didn't feel any qualms about backing out. And Abba Bar Abba was taken aback. He says, your word is worth to me more than all the money that could be, to be gotten, if you had sent me money for this deal. I was truly, felt that your commitment is rock solid. I mean, in halacha, a verbal commitment is, basically, it's like what Yogi Berra said, the great American philosopher: a verbal agreement's not worth the paper that it's written on. But Abba had really taken it to be a true commitment. Evidently, he probably had neither the funds or the interest right now to buy from him, so he couldn't buy his wares at this point. But he gave him a blessing. This is the elder sage of that generation. And he said, since you put your whole trust in my words, you should have a merit to have a son like Shmuel Hanavi, Shmuel the prophet. It's written of him. All of Yisrael from Dan until Beersheba knew that Shmuel was trusted to be a prophet of Hashem. They all relied in Shmuel. He was a man of supreme integrity, trustworthiness. They knew whatever he said as a prophet were truly words of prophecy. You yourself, I see, are a man of integrity. You expected that integrity of me. You should merit to have such a son. Abba Bar Abba eventually had a son. He named him Shmuel, because of the bracha. And evidently, the bracha, the great blessing of the saint, the tzaddik, came to be. There's another fascinating story, though, which surrounds the birth of Shmuel. This is on top of page 2. And the source of this is really not a medrash that we have extant. It's from the work the Halachos Gedolos, which is a work from the Gaonic era, from Rav Yehudoi Gaon. There's a Tosfos in Kedusha 9, Gimel Amud Aleph, that quotes this, at least part of this. Here we quote it in its entirety. It's a fascinating story. As you see from the story, it's not so easy being a silk salesman. Abba Bar Abba went on a business trip. And he was a Median woman from Modai, this is from northern Persian, who seems to have been somewhat of a psychic. As if she understood the speech of birds, in other words, not the chirping, it means the psychic signs, which the Talmud deals with very often, that they could pick up, as the Ramban explains in Chumash, that they can pick up basically the vibrations of that which will be good or bad that will come to the world. In other words, one who can interpret those signs basically can interpret the future. She saw that from this man, the silk dealer dealing with, that a great man would come forth from. He would have a great child. This Median woman, this non-Jewish woman, felt that she would be the mother of that child, and therefore attempted to seduce him. He fled. And as this is, as he brings this medrash, evidently Abba Bar Abba, not only as we're going to see, is a great Talmud Chacham, but evidently he was a Mekubal as well, was a mystic as well. He knew the Shema Mefarish, he knew the divine name. And by use of using the divine name, he was able to transport himself from where he was, very far, back home. And he came back home, and he had relations with his wife. He stayed there. She was evidently, it's quite possible, because he was aroused by her attempt of seduction, that he came home. He had relations with his wife, and he went back to wherever he was doing business. He was away for a long time. People did not know about this clandestine return. And when she became pregnant, they suspected his wife of adultery. In fact, she was flogged. They didn't put the death sentence, it didn't go on, but as a punishment, as a means of deterrence for the whole community, this woman was unjustly flogged. Shmuel says that he recalled what occurred to him in utero. That is when he was a fetus. I don't know how old, and how much along, but he had recollection of what had occurred to him. And he remembered that he was about to be flogged, and he tried to move his head to avoid being hit. Unsuccessful. But he remembered it. You know, it's fascinating. Under hypnosis, there are people who recall what occurred to them in utero. You know, next week, I mean, there's going to be a medical conference. But I'm not speaking about abortion. Shmuel himself, along with many of the great Talmudic sages, had a phenomenal memory. Here, on paragraph C, on page 2, this is Yerushalmi Ksubas, this is Perek Hay, this is the fifth chapter, this is the sixth section, Halacha Vov. Shmuel says, I recognize the midwife that delivered me. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, a contemporary of Shmuel, says, I recognize the moil that performed my circumcision. It's a moil and beware. Rabbi Yochanan says, I recognize the woman who accompanied my mother at birth. In other words, she was just a friend, you know, came for moral support. She was her Lamas instructor. You know. But it's just, it's amazing. And here, says, are people who have a memory, which basically that really only comes out normally under hypnosis. I mean, we have a tremendous storehouse of memory. But it's really, it's in our subconscious. And people who are able, you know, to tap their subconscious, either that or it's just, they have a tremendous conscious memory. We don't have a record of who the teachers of Shmuel were. We know that even though we consider this is Eretz Yisrael, Palestine, at the time as the center of Torah, Babylon produced many, many great scholars and had yeshivas during the whole period from the original exile to Babylon at the end of the first temple, all the way, he says, you know, into the sixth millennium. Before the sixth millennium, there were yeshivas in Babylon. This is of great scholars even 100 years ago. So the names of his teachers we don't know, but we do know that he studied by his father. His father was one of the great scholars of the generation. And we do have there's a very cute story which is recorded in the Gemara in Chulin Kuf Zayin Amud Beis and 107b. And anyone who's had problems with teachers in day school will really sympathize with this story. This is on the bottom of page 2. The father of Shmuel once found Shmuel crying and asked, "What are you crying about?" He says, "My Rebbe beat me." You know, this is before they introduced him these new laws. You know. He says, "Why?" He says, "I was feeding his son and I didn't wash my hands." So the father says, "Taka, why didn't you wash your hands?" So he says, "He's eating, I should wash my hands." And the person who eats washes his hands. Someone who just is a food preparer, I mean, besides cleanliness, but just the washing your hands with a kli, with a vessel, says it's only the one who eats. Well, I consider myself just a food preparer, you know, just the person who puts the bread down on the table doesn't have to wash his hands ritually, maybe hygienically, but doesn't have to ritually wash his hands. It's only the one who actually eats washes his hands. Well, so I'm putting it on the table, I put it into his mouth. But he's the eater, not me. So the father Shmuel agreed with his son. And he says, "You know what? It's not bad. It's not that this teacher is ignorant. Says, but he had to beat you too. You know, he has to prove that he's right by hitting you. And the law is that that if you are a feeder of someone, you do not have to wash your hands. Only the one who actually is the eater, you know, it says basically you're just in food preparation, has to be hygienically clean, but doesn't have to be ritually washed." But just a fascinating story about how the child was wrongfully, you know, hurt because of the ignorance of the teacher. You could look at the other, on page 3, the other citations of the relationship of Shmuel with his father. But I'd like to continue on with the father of Shmuel himself. There is a work from the time of the Gaonim called the Seder Tanoim Vamaroyim. In the version that we quoted last week, and this is based on the Geras of Shvirigon, this is in the work of Shvirigon, the one of the last of the Gaonim, who's a letter that really describes the history of Torah, and especially the creation of the Mishnah, and from that time on the leadership in Babylon. That work is a major historical source to reconstruct much of Jewish history of that period. In that work that we quoted, the leader of Jewry, when Rav, this is Shmuel's colleague, came from Eretz Yisroel to Babel, the leader was Rav Shiloh. In the Seder Tanoim V'Amoroim, another work from that period, he refers to Rabbi Abba, in other words, Shmuel's father, it would seem, as the leader in Babylon. And according to this version, as long as Rabbi Abba was alive, Rav did not take a position of leadership. But it just gives you a sense of his formidable position, Rabbi Abba, this is Shmuel's father, amongst in Babylonian Jewry. There are often times, and we've made some of these quotes here on page 4, where Shmuel's father is quoted. Either he is asked for direction from other scholars in issues of law, or he himself asks for directions from the leading scholars in Eretz Yisrael and Israel. On paragraph C on page 4, we quote a question that he posed to Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya. Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya was the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Hanosi, a man of great stature. He was still alive when Rav came down to Bavel. But one of the most amazing stories that's really recorded in the Talmud is on page 5, and we would like to read it together with you. It's a story that combines not only a greater appreciation for Abba Bar Abba, Shmuel's father, but also gives us a heightened appreciation of Shmuel himself, as well as a look into the spiritual world. Shmuel's father died, and he had money that was deposited with him for the care of orphans. And notice he was a guardian, you know, in other words, he was a trustee for these funds. But he had not entrusted the whereabouts to anyone. So when he died, no one knew where these funds were. And these people can be very cruel. The rumor had it that somehow he had absconded with the money because he had not left any instructions of what to do with the money. And they even referred to Shmuel himself as the son of the man who consumed the money of orphans. Shmuel was not told where the money is, because he went to the cemetery. And evidently, if this we're dealing with a mystic experience, and quite possibly what had occurred, really, I mean, he had an out-of-body experience. He went to the spiritual world, and he went where the disembodied souls are, the Olam HaNeshamas. And he came to the caretaker of it, and he says, "I am looking for Abba." And he said, "There are many Abbas over here. Common name. Well, I want Abba Bar Abba." That's very uncommon. We don't know exactly why it's called Abba, the son of Abba. It's very rare. It's quite possible that his father died while, you know, before he was named, and therefore he was named after his father. But we don't have any specific, you know, knowledge of the fact. But it was there's several Abba Bar Abbas here too. You can imagine going through the list, you know. I want Abba Bar Abba, the father of Shmuel. And he was really always known, it's an amazing thing, as the father of Shmuel, even though his name is Abba Bar Abba. But throughout the Talmud it's called Abua de Shmuel, Shmuel's father. Could be for one reason because Shmuel at least is known to us as the is the great teacher of Jewry. That position, at least we don't have enough material from Abba Bar Abba that he qualified to be our teacher. It could very well be because of the story that we read previously, because there was a question of the paternity of the child. He was always called Abua de Shmuel, always known as Shmuel's father. Don't have any, you know, you shouldn't think that he truly is not Shmuel's father. No, yes, he is. This is Shmuel's father. But whatever the case is, he said, where is he? He's in yeshiva. He's in Masifta Derekia. He's in the yeshiva of heaven. You know, it's fascinating. Many of those who have out-of-body experiences, as those who have been at death's door, those who are close to death, and who were unconscious or their heart had stopped for a considerable amount of time, claim that they had not only left their body and saw the happenings of what occurred to them in the room around them, but they had, this is a subject I'm going to be speaking about, by the way, next week at the conference, but they claim that they went to the spiritual world, and they refer to it as a one large university. I mean, they were sitting and learning. But evidently, it seems there are levels of, there are universities and there are yeshivas. The father Shmuel was in a yeshiva. It was in a sifter camp. And when he came there, when Shmuel came there, in other words, his disembodied spirit came there, he saw Levi. Levi had been a colleague of his, Levi Bar Sisi. He was one of the great disciples of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi. And he said to him, "What are you sitting outside?" And he replied, "It's really, it's a form of punishment." When Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi died, he left instructions that Rabbi Hanina, and this is something we'd covered 2 weeks ago, Rabbi Hanina would be named Rosh Yeshiva. He felt he, amongst all the of his disciples, was the most fit for that position. Rabbi Hanina declined because Rabbi Ephes was 2.5 years older than he. And he felt it would be a... it would hurt, basically, Rabbi Ephes' feelings if he took the position. And he deferred to him, and he gave, Rabbi Hanina gave Rabbi Ephes that position that really should have been his. But Rabbi Ephes was a man of a smaller stature than Rabbi Hanina. Levi was a colleague of Rabbi Hanina, did not feel comfortable that he would have to defer to Rabbi Ephes. So he stayed out of the... He remained in Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael. I refer to this Palestine because this was still the Roman province, we call it. It wasn't Israel, the state of Israel. The Malchus Yisrael, of course, the country called Yisrael from antiquity, came to an end 100 years before the destruction of the first temple. And under the Romans, it was either called Judea, it was a sub part of Palestine, or eventually, during the late Mishnaic times, it was just simply called Palestine. Levi didn't feel comfortable submitting himself to the authority of Rabbi Ephes, so he sat outside the yeshiva with Rabbi Hanina. Rabbi Hanina didn't feel comfortable because he was a person of truly greater stature. So he kept Rabbi Hanina company. I mean, they learned together, they were chavrusas, whatever it was, but he wasn't part of Rabbi Ephes' yeshiva. When Rabbi Ephes died, this is a Gemara Nun Tes Amud Beis, this is 59b in Shabbos. When Rabbi Ephes died, Rabbi Hanina then became Rosh Yeshiva. Levi Bar Sisi, who was a colleague of his, of Rabbi Hanina, at this point did not feel comfortable deferring to Rabbi Hanina, his colleague as Rosh Yeshiva. He did not want to slight Rabbi Hanina by staying, and he felt that really he had no place. He left for Babylon, just as Rav, some years before, had left. Levi followed suit, and Levi left to Babylon. There Levi became a fast friend of Abuah de Shmuel, of Shmuel's father. They were of that same age, the same generation. Now that Shmuel found his disembodied soul, spirit, found Levi's spirit outside the Beis Medrash, outside the Masifta Drakia, he said that this was a form of punishment because all those years that he had hurt Rabbi Ephes' feelings and stayed out, he is now being paid back, that he is not allowed into the yeshiva himself. What, you want to stay out of the yeshiva? And he was, and this is a form of punishment. So he passed him, and he went into the yeshiva. I mean, he came and he met his father. I mean, his father. And when his father saw him, evidently it seems something that his father left, basically what we call the base medrash, he left the Masifta Rikia. He came to him, and he saw him, this is both weeping and laughing. I guess we have to understand how it happens, basically. You don't have a body, but there's... again, those who've had a near-death experience explain those that they look at themselves in their disembodied state, and they look at themselves that they do have some sort of a body. They don't look the same, but there's a place of them would be arms, would be legs. You know, Kabbalistically, that we, you know, in Kabbalah, we have a spiritual body. It's a real body. Every part of that body has a correspondence to the 613 mitzvahs. And we are negligent or lax or violate any one of them, it really shows up on the body. In a certain sense, just as physically we would abuse our body by smoking or doing other things, you could look at the lungs, you could see he's a smoker. Here it says, if you look at the spiritual body, you'd see he does this or he does that or he does the other thing. So there really is a, it has somewhat of a body. Shmuel sees his father, the deceased father, weeping and laughing. He says, "What are you crying for?" "Because I see you're coming here soon." This, evidently it would be some time had lapsed, you know, when his father's death and he came. Shmuel already was an older person. And he says, "It's not so long and you too will be part of this world. And why are you laughing? Because you're highly esteemed in this world." Evidently, when he came, he told him, you know, he was told, you know, there's a man of great, you know, of great prominence who has entered our world. He says, you know, if I'm so esteemed, I want them to do me a favor then. So take in Levi. As Levi Bar Sisi led him into the yeshiva, and they did. This is what pool can do, by the way. I mean, this is the basis, same thing why we'd go to a tzaddik. You know, evidently there are people that have pool. And he said to him, really, this was his, now they went down to business. He says, "Where's the money? You know, wo de geld? You know, what happened with the money of the orphans?" And he said, and this is a fascinating thing about what responsibility is. He says, if you go and find in the middle of the millstones, notice he had a millstone, says, "I put it right in the middle." Says, "There's money, there are other monies there. The money at the top is mine and the bottom is mine." Evidently they were like in different cases or bags. "The middle is the orphans." And Shmuel asked him, "Why did you do that?" He says, "You know, if thieves come..." Evidently there were layers in between each one of them. It wasn't just stacked one on top of the other. "If things come, they'll take mine." Evidently, when they find it, they'll figure the top one, well, that's the only thing that's there. Evidently there was something blocking the view of the neck one. They wouldn't even think about looking further. So if they take it, they'll take mine. He felt his responsibility to these orphans was more than his responsibility to his own money. So if they take it, they take mine. If there's a problem because the earth, you know, eats it, in other words, because of the corrosion, evidently there, it wasn't gold coins, it was something that was subject to corrosion, it'll destroy mine, the bottom ones. Well, I didn't want to put it on the bottom either. I wanted to be a buffer. So evidently he was more worried about his, you know, again, someone else's, that which he's entrusted to, than his own. It gives you an insight not only into, the fact is evidently that Shmuel himself was a mekubal, was a mystic. I mean, he was able to do this. But it gives you in a sense of what the spiritual world is like. And perhaps even more importantly, what Abba Bar Abba's integrity was, and of his responsibility to the money of others. As we stated before, Shmuel, his son, excelled not only in the areas of learning. But he was a great astronomer and doctor as well. There's this on page 6. It's a very famous quote. It says, Omer Shmuel Nehiren Lishvili de Shemaya Kishvili de Nahardo. I'm as familiar with the paths of heaven as with the streets of Nahardo. Except with the exception of a certain comet, which he's ignorant of. But all that which was, all the knowledge that was current, I mean, he was familiar with basically with all that was available to know about astronomy. Reminds me of a beautiful little story that I heard from a Talmud of Rav Huttner's, that's all. Rav Huttner was walking together with Rav Kook, that's all. And there had been just a newspaper article written about Rav Kook, very complimentary. And as they're walking the streets and the byways of Yerushalayim, they got lost. The article had just been written about him. It says, Nehiren Le, says, Shvili, says the Yerushalmi, the paths of the Talmud Yerushalmi are clear to Rav Kook. It says, Kishvili the Yerushalayim is the paths of Jerusalem. He says, I sure hope the reporter's not here now. Not only did he know astronomy in terms of constellations and the movements, he was very clear in the whole calculations of the calendar. And he makes the statement here, this is in Rosh Hashanah and Chof Amud Beis, in 20b, that I'm, it says, Yechilna Leskuna Lekula Goyla. I'm quite able to make a calendar for the whole of the diaspora. So here is skilled not only in astronomy, but also in the calculations of the calendars. In fact, Shmuel at one point sent to Rabbi Yo after Rav died, and when Rav was nifter, Rabbi Yochanan up until that time had always deferred to Rav. He looked at Rav as his mentor. When he wrote to Shmuel subsequently, because evidently he had taken the after when Rav, which was the subject of last week's lecture, died, and Rav had created an alternate yeshiva, a masifta in Surah. So he had Shmuel's masifta, his yeshiva in Nahardo. This is Rav's in Surah, and it became two centers of Torah in Babylon. After Rav was nifter, it was only Shmuel. So Rabbi Yochanan started corresponding to Shmuel. Rabbi Yochanan then was the leading Rosh Yeshiva, leading head of yeshiva in Palestine, in Israel. And he referred to Shmuel as my colleague Shmuel. That's how he titled it. To Rav, he wrote, as my master Rav. To Shmuel, my colleague. Shmuel felt, he was really a colleague, I think, that Shmuel was a person that Rabbi Yochanan could really learn from. And he wanted to show, you know, his vast knowledge, you know. And he sent him the calculations, says, of months for 60 years. For 60 years, how to calculate the calendar. Rabbi Yochanan was not impressed. Anyone could be a mathematician. It's not a riot, it's not a proof you're a godel. He sent him, though, much material about his work on Trefus, you know, which is a very difficult thing about internal wounds, sicknesses of animals that make them deathly sick, which are prohibited by the Torah. Rabbi Yochanan was impressed and started deferring now to Shmuel. But Shmuel evidently thought it was really something. I mean, evidently that Shmuel's ability to calculate was very rare. Otherwise, he would have never even attempted to impress Rabbi Yochanan. Of course, his expertise in medicine was phenomenal, at least of the time. And he made the statement that for any sickness, I know the medicine, except for three. One of them is something which affects our time, if times haven't changed, is that eating and not walking afterwards. Here the Gemara quotes this in relationship that a person, they used to, as we said in the previous lecture, they used to eat on beds. In other words, not like we eat on chairs, but they used to recline on beds. But the bed that they reclined on was different than the bed that they ate, that they slept on. And the Gemara there is referring to how we settle debts. How do we collect from someone who has very little to pay? And even though basically we take everything, and this is the that all his assets are taken, and it's to pay the debt, he is still left with that which he can continue on living and making a livelihood. And he said he is left with two beds. And the Talmud asked the question, why does he have to have two beds? Well, one could do double duty. And he said, he dealt with the fear that if he only has one bed, he will eat and fall asleep on that bed. And it is important for him to get up after his meal and walk around a little bit. And in that relationship, in that regard, Shmuel is quoted. But evidently, Shmuel didn't know a cure. The sickness is the result from this. So the Eibishter Rapit, it was, even Shmuel didn't know the cure. But evidently, it gives you indicative of his far range of knowledge of medicine. In fact, his expertise went to that a woman had a spontaneous abortion. And a sack, evidently, what was the fetus, he examined it and he says, this is 41 days old. And this is the probably of how it had developed, and this is 41 days old. And they calculated at the time that the baby had been formed, had been conceived, this woman had not gone to the mikveh. And they used they use Shmuel's expert testimony against this woman. But Shmuel, as it says, was unusual because there was no other doctor who had that ability to discern. This is how the growth rate of a child says, and the maturity of a fetus at 41 days old. Shmuel's expertise came to the service of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the bottom of page 7. And the Gemara brings this as a historical source for many different things. Shmuel, the Gemara's Yachino, was Rabbi's physician. Evidently there was a time Shmuel came to Eretz Yisrael to study under Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Historians offer the theory that the reason Rav did not know Shmuel, or Shmuel did not know Rav, that was we studied last week, that when Rav came up to Bavel, Shmuel didn't know the status, the scholarship of Rav, and he sent first Karna to test them out. What do you mean? Shmuel went to study by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rav was one of the leading students of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Why didn't he know, who Rav was? And the answer that I've seen is we know there was a period of time that Rav left Palestine, went down to Bavel, and it would seem then their paths crossed. As when Rav came down to Bavel, that was the time that Shmuel went up to Palestine, Eretz Yisrael, Israel. And at that time, Shmuel studied under, and evidently their paths crossed again, never the twain shall meet. So that for that reason, Shmuel did not know Rav until Rav finally settled in Bavel. But he became Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's physician. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi contracted an eye disease, and it was really because of his expertise, and it was very difficult because he couldn't apply ointment to it because the pain was excruciating. He put a vial of chemicals under his pillow, under Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's pillow. The odor of the chemicals itself created the healing, like the vapors created the healing. And he used his genius, to heal the eye disease. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was very anxious to give him smicha. Evidently, he was very impressed from this, who personally, basically, it seems, only studied a very short time under him. But his knowledge was phenomenal. And he saw such a person of such stature should be given smicha, and should be given the ordination to become a judge. He declined Shmuel. He didn't want to take it. What happened was that he attempted to do so. It's important that first there has to be a bezdin, can be at least of three people. It would seem that also that the has to be a person that's acceptable to the community as a whole. And for some reason, the conditions were not such that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was able to give him smicha. And Shmuel was not moved by it, and he told him, he says, don't worry about this. I've seen, and it would seem, most commentaries take this for face, again, we said that Shmuel was a mekubal. He was a mystic. I've seen, this is the book of Odom. In other words, the Odom HaRishon. It says, there was a book that was basically, it's the map of history that was shown to the first man. That all that will occur has been, there's a certain preordination. He had a glimpse into this. In that it says, Shmuel Yarchi Noah says, will be called a chacham, will be called a sage. He will not be called Rabbi, as he will not get the official ordination. He will never be officially a judge in a Sanhedrin, in a Beis Din. However, he is destined to be the doctor of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi will be healed through him. It also includes of what he saw in this mystic vision, that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nosson, who was preordained, will conclude the Mishnah, Soif Mishnah. They were those who finally edited the Mishnah. Rav Ashi and Ravina, is Soif Hayra, they will complete the teaching of the Talmud. So Rabbi Yehuda so Shmuel evidently was of the level to receive smicha, but he did not. Very often, when we deal with someone who is so talented, order his priorities. In a certain sense, one could well argue that one deals in astronomy or medicine. These are all areas of wisdom which are created by God Himself. And this is not accounting or law, or is it a man-made discipline? This is God's creation. And one could well argue that they should have a very exalted status, and perhaps equal to that of Torah, because after all, these are all bodies of knowledge, fascinating bodies that are created by God. In addition, not only the fact is they were created by God, but there's a medrash which Rambam quotes. Rambam's in the Geras, and it would seem to be the source of that which he says in the Yad HaChazaka. That if one looks at nature, looks at God's creation, one can become a very spiritual person, a person very closely attached to Hashem, who wants to cling to Him and to know Him. In fact, he says that's the way that one cultivates love of God is through the study of the heavens, the study of nature. It's very interesting to know, it says, how Shmuel himself prioritized his knowledge. In the beginning, on top of page 8, in Parshas Netzavim, where Hashem is referring to the Torah, and he says, I've given it to you, lo b'shamayim, it's not in the heavens. The simple meaning, of course, is it's accessible, and it's brought lahalacha, that one does not ask a prophet to clarify the words of the Torah. The Torah has been given already. It's part of the Mesorah, it's part of the tradition. Something you yourself have to grapple with, you have to go to a Rebbe for. It's not, the prophecy of Torah has come to an end. That's the simple meaning of the verse. There's a drusha, though. There's a homiletic interpretation here, which Shmuel himself offered. He says, Ein ha-Torah metzuya bistralugin. The Torah is not found by astrologers or astronomers whose profession deals with the stars. If you want to know Torah, you have to study Torah, not astronomy. You know, it reminds me of a very cute story. I heard this from Shmuel Kaufman. Everyone's laughing already. That there were two rabbonim who were in the train station waiting for their children to come home. And one asked the other, says, where's your son? Where are you waiting for? My son learns in Volozhin. This goes back well over 100 years ago. My son learns in the yeshiva of Volozhin. He's learned so many years. He's become Kanayin Hora, such a Talmud Chacham. He's been away for so long. You know, I just want to go see him. It's wonderful. And the one whose son is of Volozhin turned to the other Rav and he says, where's your son? And his son, his face had fallen. I says, my son had studied, says, went away to Paris and studied in the university and he's got his degree and he's coming back. He says, Halavai, my son would be coming back from Volozhin. And to this, the first Rav replied, maybe I should say it like Shmuley Kaufman, if you send him to Volozhin, he comes back from Volozhin. If you send him to Paris, you can't expect him to come back from Volozhin. In other words, you go to Paris, you come back a Parisian, a cosmopolitan, very well polished, one who knows very well the ways of the world, but not a Talmud Chacham. Shmuel said, if you want to know Torah, you have to study Torah. So they asked Shmuel, hey, wait a minute, you? So you're an astronomer. You yourself are an astrologer. And you, so you're an autumn, so you can see you have both. He says, you know when I was? Says, at a time where I couldn't learn Torah. As it was in the bathhouse, in the bathroom. Says, I did it in time where I couldn't learn. Every minute that I could study Torah, I studied Torah. So it gives you just a sense of how at least Shmuel prioritized his life. It's amazing. I mean, it would come out normally as a surprise, and there's normally you wouldn't have expected that answer from a person of that. But this is how Shmuel himself looked at what the study of Torah is. As we said in the beginning of the class, he had many titles. As you can look through yourself on page 8, he was a shokud, he was industrious. He didn't rely on his own, and again, a lesson for all of us, he didn't rely on his own genius. Well, he's naturally gifted. He had this blessing for Yehuda ben Becerra, and he was he had this tremendous memory. Remember the midwife, and was, you know, he remembered what happened to him in utero. He was shokud, he was always studying. As he said, he was called Shavar Amalko, King Shapur. And even though, as we said before, we said last week's class, that really of the two, between Rav and Shmuel, Rav was the superior of Shmuel. But when it came to civil law, to Dine Momonos, Shmuel was his superior. And that's why in questions of deciding laws, when there's law, when there's a machlokas, when there's an argument between Rav and Shmuel, in Dine Momonos, Bedini, we paskin, we rule like Shmuel. Shmuel himself not only was called Shavar Amalka, King Shapur, but he had a very, it seems, a very close relationship with King Shapur. We had stated in previous lectures about the political relationships, close political relations that the other great people of the time had. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had his close relationship with Antoninus, as we said, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. Rav had a close relationship, the R. Girsis Adrachon, others explain this as Beartavon, the king of the Parthians. Shmuel had a close relationship to King Shapur. This is Shapur the First, a contemporary of Shmuel's. And in fact, he was not only had an agile mind, he had an agile hand as well. Shmuel juggled 8 glasses of wine in front of King Shapur. I don't know if any of you have ever juggled, but this is a kunst. Shapur says like this, is a fascinating thing. He told him, his Shapur, this is on page 9, paragraph B, it's an amazing story. He says, you, and it seems that he said in the plural, referring to all Jews, you know, you say that you're very smart. Well, if you're so smart, tell me, what am I going to dream about tonight? So he said, you know, the Persians, first the Parthians and the Persians, were always constantly fighting against the Romans. He says, what you will see in your dream is the Romans will take you captive and will make you grind the pits, the date stones of dates, evidently to be used for animal fodder. That's how he used to. He says, in a golden mill. This is what you're going to see. There's a millstone made out of gold that they will force you to mill these stones. Just as an aside, milling generally, at least by the Romans, was done by pack animals. A slave that was punished was forced to mill, because it was such backbreaking work that it was used as a form of punishment by the Romans. So he will be forced to do this, but it will be a golden mill. The vividness of that description stuck in his mind, this King Shapur's mind, that he thought about it the whole day, and that's what he dreamt about. And the Gemara brings the conjunction, the fact is, you dream about that which you think about during the day. That secret he knew, he told him, and it was so outlandish, and it brought up all his fears, you know, that he should be not only captured, but treated as a menial slave. Because only the most menial of slaves, those who were to be punished, would mill. And the most, basically, the most outlandish thing had be a golden millstone. So it just stuck in his mind that that's what he dreamed about. Very often, throughout the Gemara, we find constant arguments between Rav and Shmuel. And Rav from Hochi, Shmuel, Hochi. They're always arguing. Shmuel took the passing of Rav very seriously. And in fact, on 13 different occasions, of the first one who was told, but different occasions when he remembered Rav or what he had said, He riced kriya. He tore his garments, like one hears about the death of someone. As the Gemara explains, it was an ace chimum. It was a time that he was full of emotion. Even evidently, this at some time it passed after his death, but he still bemoaned and cried his passing. And when he tore the garments, says ozo gavra dehava mistafina mine. Says gone is the man for whom I trembled, because he knew that if he would say something, it would be a little off, Rav would go and disagree with him and show that he's wrong. So that itself, knowing that someone is there to always criticize you, I mean, and not in a nasty way, but basically is someone to set you right, will make you think it over 1,000 times before you make a public statement. Because you know, once you make that statement and it's wrong, it's going to be criticized. I don't have that person anymore. Like, I'm on my own. There's a similar incident which is described in the Gemara. There's a Gemara in Gemara in Pei Dalet in Bava Metzia, that when Reish Lakish died, Reish Lakish was the colleague of Rabbi Yochanan, brother-in-law, and the colleague of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was the Rosh Yeshiva. And Reish Lakish was the first among equals, and he would be the one to comment on Rabbi Yochanan's shiur, Rabbi Yochanan's lecture. When Reish Lakish died, another disciple, Rabbi Elazar, took that position. And when Rabbi Yochanan would give his lecture, says Rabbi Elazar would comment, this is 24 place, he would comment about how right he was and give support to his position, you know, that this thing supports you and that thing. And Rabbi Yochanan says, when I used to give a shiur and Reish Lakish was alive, he would criticize me and challenge me from 24 places and show that I'm wrong. And I had to defend myself. And through the give and the take, says, of defending myself, a whole new understanding grew in so many different places. He says, I don't need someone to tell me that I'm right. I know I'm right. I need someone to challenge me and tell me that I'm wrong. And he became so taken, I mean, by the fact of the Reish Lakish had passed, that he became deranged, you know, and they prayed, and he died. I've heard the comment that the rabbis, instead of praying that, you know, that after he became deranged, or became deranged, that he die, they should have prayed that he become healed from his derangement. And the answer they give is, it wouldn't help to be healed from the derangement, because still Reish Lakish is not here. He'll become deranged again. So also that they prayed was that he should be nifter, should die. When Rav died, Shmuel was so taken by the fact that there was no one to criticize him. The story is told from Rav Bakst, you know, that when the Brisker Rav was nifter, Zev Soloveitchik itself, the Brisker Rav was nifter, says Rav Yosef Kahaneman, the Ponovizhe Rav, the founder of the Yeshiva in Ponovizhe, bemoaned him, says, with the same thing, by his hesped, says, Ozo Gavra de Hava Mistafina Mine. The man that I trembled before has gone. Whatever he did, Ponovizhe Rav dealt with all kinds of elements in Israeli society. Whatever he would do and make a public pronouncement, he was always afraid, what would the Brisker Rav say? And that kept him in line. He doesn't have the Brisker Rav anymore. Ozo Gavra de Mistafina Mine. After Rav died, Rav's Talmidim, who did not go over to Shmuel, there were a number that went over to Shmuel. We know Rav Huna studied under Shmuel after Rav died. Rav Yehuda studied under Shmuel. These are personages that we'll discuss in subsequent lectures. But there were a number of Talmidim that stayed in the yeshiva of Rav. One of them, it seems, is Rav Hamnuna. And he led the yeshiva of Rav after Rav had passed away. This is where others had gone to Shmuel, the yeshiva still remained. But they would constantly send to Shmuel to seek advice. And here we find in the Gemara, Sholcholei mebei Rav leShmuel, the yeshiva was sent to Shmuel, and Bei Rav and the yeshiva Shmuel, under the leadership of Rav Hamnuna, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, says, teach us our master regarding various issues of Talmudic law. I'd just like to leave you with some of the legacy, some of the famous sayings of Shmuel that we could learn from in our own lives. We started off this lecture with the story of Yehuda ben Becerra, that he had given a blessing to Shmuel's father, that you should have a man as trustworthy as Shmuel the prophet. Evidently, his namesake, Shmuel was a person that was tremendously honest. And maybe that's why he had the schus, the merit to be our teacher, regards subjects of honesty. One is, which is a source of halachas, also lignav das habrios, it's forbidden to deceive people, even a non-Jew. selling him substandard merchandise. Or even as referred to the fact is you feel that he would feel that you're doing him a favor when you're really not. Here the Talmud deals with situations that really you don't want to honor the person, but you give him the feeling that you would have honored him. For instance, you know someone's coming in, he's not going to eat by your house for some reason, he's eaten already or he's going to go on the road, and you make very an emotional plea to come and eat by me and I really want you. You made the person feel wonderful. And he'll be indebted to you because of your goodwill. But you really don't want to feed the person. You're only doing it because you know he's not going to eat by you. That's going of Das Abrius. You're stealing their mind. You're stealing their goodwill. This form of insincerity and theft is forbid not only against Jews, but against non-Jews as well. You have to be honest. They were very sensitive, on page 11, were very sensitive, and this is a theme which is brought out in the Talmud in various forms, about price stabilization. I don't remember the story some years back, and it was the Hunt brothers that cornered the market on silver. And as a result, the price of silver rose to $40 an ounce. Ochen veit, the person invested in silver during that time. That practice was common, unfortunately, even Talmudic times. And it refers, you could look at yourself at that both the father of Shmuel and Shmuel himself try to somehow stabilize the market. You have the same thing in the currency markets today, where they will buy up. You'll find the European countries or the Japanese countries will buy up the extra, you know, to boost the price if the price of the dollar is falling. The same means of price stabilization were used just in those times as well. What they would do would be buy a large, you know, they would buy their produce and just have a, and when the price would start being rising because of the because those who had hoarded, they would flood the market with their goods and stabilize the prices. The father of Shmuel did it early on, so that prevented really from the price really to ever rise. Shmuel did it later in the process with less positive results. Both, though, were very much involved in this. They were very concerned about poor people, that they're because of price manipulation or cornering the market, they should suffer. This is Delia. You can look. This is in paragraph C. We deal with a situation where people were concerned about the price of pots. You know, after Pesach, people got rid of their pots. And that earthenware pots. They got rid of their pots and bought new pots, and the price of new pots were exorbitant. Shmuel told the pot dealers more than they would normally, with just a normative. It was price gouging. It wasn't just a normal profit margin. He says, you know, put down your prices or I'm going to tell everyone they don't have to take care of their pots. They don't have to leave them open. They can leave their pots over Pesach and I'll just drive you out of business entirely. So the Gemara asks the question, so why didn't he do it? So he says, Rav's opinion was that one is not allowed to use those pots, after those earthenware pots. I mean, they can't be kashered. They're not allowed to be used after Pesach. Because it was Rav's, it was a place where Rav was once under his domain, because there were two different parts, as we said last week. There was Surah, and this is in Nahar Dor. Shmuel was in Nahar Dor. Rav was in Surah. The Mora, the Asra, the one who was the Posek, says even maybe if Rav is not alive, was Rav. He didn't want to interfere. He couldn't. However, he wanted to scare the merchants. So therefore he threatened them, hoping that the threat would at least they would ease up the prices. There's a story associated with Shmuel. Shmuel is not really a key figure here, but his teaching is really something to teach all of us. There's a rule, we dealt with mysticism before, an afterlife experience. There is an idea of mazel, of basherkeit. We know that something is bashert, it's ordained at Rosh Hashanah. Mzonoisav shaladim ktsuvan loim at Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara says in Beitza and Beya and Tezayin Amad Aleph in 16a, that what a person is going to make through the year is ordained on Rosh Hashanah. There's a ordainment, though, that happens when the child, before the child is born. There's a Gemara Nida, Tezayin Amad Beis in 16b, because before the child is born, it is brought just the embryo, you know, before, as it's beginning just to grow, is brought, figuratively speaking, before the divine throne. And the Malach asks Hashem, this is Lila, this is the Malach that's Munan Heroyan, the angel of conception, says, what will the child be? The answer is not Kesara Sara. It says, and it's determined, so he'll be rich or poor, if he'll live a long life, or short. I mean, whether a person will be weak physically, I mean, this whole thing. But if a person will be a Yorei Shamayim, the fear of heaven is not predetermined. That's where a person actually has free will, which we've discussed in the previous lecture, 2 weeks ago. Shmuel made a statement. I mean, we see that even though there is a certain basherkeit, which is basically is the mazel, and we know it depends on where. The Talmud speaks about when a person is born, under what planetary influences. It is really also part of the plan of how his life will be mapped out. However, a mazel Yisrael, a Jew could change that mazel. Through one's prayer, one's exceptional deeds, one could change the game plan, so to speak. And normally, Hashem does not interfere. This will not change the game plan. But for the Jewish people, under extraordinary circumstances, he will. And that's Ein Mazel Yisrael. And it brings a story, and you can look at the details yourself, about a Jew who had found they were woodcutters, and in the wood they found a snake that had been severed, had been killed by the wood unknowingly. And this, had he not given the blow at the right time, that snake would have killed the person. It was a poisonous snake. And looking at it, and Shmuel had a colleague who was a non-Jewish astrologer, evidently a psychic, who said that this person is going to die. As they're walking, to cut the wood, he said, that person is going to die today. And Shmuel says, if he's Jewish, I wouldn't make any bets on it. When he came back alive, this woodcutter, after it had been predicted he's going to die, they looked at the wood and they found the severed snake. And he says, did you do anything today unusual? He says, every day, it was in the middle of the paragraph, page 12, we pooled our bread and ate it. Notice they all had, but today one of us had no bread, and he was ashamed. Notice every day they put all their bread into it, they didn't keep it separately. Everyone brought a loaf of bread, they put it into a common thing, and then afterwards each one took a piece of bread. This one had forgotten it and didn't put it in the pool. And he was ashamed. So I said, I will go and collect the bread. When I come to you, I'll pretend that, when it comes to me, I pretended to take it, and you'll have your bread and you'll eat, and don't worry, you won't be ashamed, you won't get any guilt, you'll have it. And I won't, and I said, I forgot to bring it, I'll put the blame on me, whatever. And he wanted to protect the other person. Or he feigned, eating it. He says, you did a tremendous chesed, a tremendous act of kindness. He says, and tzedakah tatzmam of us. He says, giving charity, helping someone, saves from death. Says, even a preordained death. And this is all part of things. Is Ein Mazel Yisrael, a Jew, because that's the relationship that Hashem has with the Jewish people, under extraordinary circumstances can change the mazel. Shmuel died in the year, this is 253 of the Common Era. He left great disciples. Those were Nachman, who was the Rav, the Abbezdin in Nahar Dor. Rav Yehuda became the Rosh Hashiva in Pumpadisa. And Rav Sheshes, who became in Shalchi, he says he became in Mechuza, he became one of the great sages. And of course, Shmuel's legacy and his teachings lives on with us. I'd like to just finish off with a fascinating story on the bottom of page 12. You can look at all the details, and let me just tell it over to you quickly. It's a Medrash in Koheles. It's in Parsha Zion. It's Posek Ches. It's chapter 7, verse 8. A non-Jew, a Persian, came to Rav and he says, "Teach me Torah. I want to become a convert." Rav started to teach him Torah, which is a wonderful thing. A person, if you realize, Rav was the greatest scholar of the time. Today, if you'd go to a man of such stature, equivalent to that generation, and says, "Teach me," he would send them off to some anybody. I mean, to teach them. He started teaching this convert, this Aleph Beis. I said, but this person himself was a very difficult person to deal with. And he says, this is called Aleph. He says, "How do you know it's an Aleph? How do you know? Evidently he thought, this is Beis. And the guy says, "How do you know this is a Beis?" Evidently Rav said, "This is not going to be his day. This is a person he can't deal with." He yelled at him and threw him out. The Rav himself had this, the midah of kanoyas, when he felt that this person was just wasting his time, was really an insincere person. Shmuel, though, as we said, Rav, if we would compare Rav to the great Shammai, Shmuel would be compared to Hillel. And this, there's a parallel story with Hillel. But this, the knach here, and now there's a twist on this one, is fascinating. Again, he started teaching him Aleph Beis, and he came to him and says, "Aleph." He says, "How do you know this is an Aleph?" Shmuel says, "Beis. How do you know this is a Beis?" Shmuel gave him a frashka from the ever. He hit his ear. He says, "Oi, my ear." He says, "How do you know it's an ear?" "What do you mean it's an ear? Everyone calls it an ear." "Well, everyone calls this an Aleph." Evidently, he had learned his lesson. He was quiet, and he kept on learning, and he became a gear. And it makes it that it's better to have patience than to be of the other. Now, are there any questions? It could very well be that he died suddenly. I mean, we can only theorize because. I mean, very often, it's not only in learning that historically in the Talmud, basically in any area of history, we have to reconstruct history. We're given this fact and that fact we're not given. But one would assume circumstances were such that he really just couldn't, or there's a possibility as well that the instructions had been really written out, but it wasn't, someone wasn't given over. Yes? Right. So, again, one could only theorize. Basically, when you learn the Gemara, you have the facts. As he says, one could theorize. It's quite likely, though, that basically Shmuel held himself to be a greater scholar, and really he could help Rabbi Yochanan. In other words, that he would be a mentor. Those questions of law, says, that Rabbi Yochanan would not be sure of if he would look to Shmuel himself rather. No, it would enhance it would further the authenticity of Torah. Basically, it's something that he's saying, if you have any problems, you can feel free to ask. What? What? Yeah, but what does that have to do with Gaiva here? yeah, but we have two ophthalmologists here. What? Yeah. I can't, you know, I'm really not, you know, in the midst of an ophthalmologist. That would be something we'll have to speak after. But about Shmuel, generally when we're dealing with people, I mean, just of this stature, and we see about the person who's so widely respected, his knowledge is so far-reaching, who's a mystic, you know, who's respected in heaven, the tendency is that when we deal with him, the traditional approach, I mean, in lieu of all this, is, yes, one, on a different person, one could say, well, it's a personality fault. He wants the whole world to know of his greatness. A person of that stature, though, we tend to look for a different explanation, just simply because it's so incongruous that a person of that day who is so great in all other areas should have that flaw. The tendency is to look at it as not as a flaw, right? And they didn't want Chazal, you know, who preserved that statement in the Talmud, didn't do it so in light of preserving that flaw in his character, but rather that statement was to be understood in a different light. And I think the idea was that there are two statements here. One statement is that I know all of the heavens except for that star. And basically, it's not a statement of, look how great I am, but he's saying that I've really never, this is an enigma even to me, where I've covered. And basically, it wasn't that he had studied it in books, you know, he had studied it in the bathroom. He went through all the literature. He says, I've never covered this. It isn't that there's a book that I haven't read on this, or I've covered all the extant information. The statement was really to say about the enigma that there's nothing in the literature that deals with this. And those persons, well, how do you know? Maybe there is. Believe me, I've read every book. It's not saying how great I am, but just saying about the enigma that his knowledge of astronomy, we would assume he got from the Greeks or whoever wrote on astronomy. They didn't know. The other thing when he's dealing with his ability to the statement over there in Russian is also basically was a statement, I could do everything except this, which again, the statement wasn't so I'm so great, but there's something that I'm lacking. And so let's see the whole. Yes. Yeah. All I can say is, you know, there's a famous statement. Those who know don't say, and those who say don't know. Gute Woche. Gute Woche.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.